TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. On the prospects for war in 2014, this is one of the rare news versions of TUC Radio. Recorded in the early days of 2014, the focus, with some urgency, is on the prospects for war in 2014. University of Illinois College of Law professor Francis Boyle, well-known teacher of constitutional law, attorney, and engaged critic of U.S. foreign affairs, was interviewed on January 8 by radio host Jeff Blankfort. Francis Boyle is known for his principled approach to constitutional law and his ability to intervene with writings and lawsuits in matters of human rights and civil liberties. Jeff Blankfort is a veteran journalist and commentator on the Middle East. He hosts Takes on the World, a program on international affairs on KZYX Radio in Mendocino County, California. Blankfort prefaced his interview of Professor Boyle by commenting on the sensitive negotiations that are currently underway over restructuring Iran's nuclear program. The five permanent members of the UN Security Council, that's the US, Russia, China, UK, France, plus Germany, are negotiating with Tehran over bringing the crippling sanctions imposed on Iran to an end. Beginning in 2006 to now, pushed largely by the United States, the UN Security Council has adopted six resolutions of increasing severity in response to the Iranian nuclear program. The last, Security Council Resolution 1929, adopted in June 2010, saw the expansion of more sanctions on Iran for what critics contend are uranium enrichment-related and reprocessing activities designed to produce nuclear weapons, a charge which Iran has denied. Under the previous Iranian administration, positions had hardened. However, the new president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, elected in 2013, made conciliatory comments, and negotiations soon began. They were held between Iran and the UN Security Council, plus Germany. As of January 10, 2014, an implementation agreement was arrived at that is now awaiting signatures at the P5+1 presidential levels. However, at the same time, a bill, S-1881, has been introduced in the U.S. Senate over President Obama's objections. That bill could bring these efforts for a negotiated solution to an end, and even worse, has language embedded that would oblige the U.S. to go to war on the side of Israel if Israel were to decide unilaterally to attack Iran. Here's Jeff Blankfort.
When we last spoke, President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry had been pleading with Congress not to pass any new sanctions legislation that might cause a breakdown in the discussion with Iran about curtailing its nuclear program. To pass new sanctions on top of those in place, they said, would lead to Tehran pulling out of its negotiations with the P5 nations plus Germany, not to mention violating an agreement that U.S. negotiators made with Iran as a prerequisite to holding the current talks. Pushing against the White House has been Israel's forward base on U.S. soil, AIPAC, its registered domestic lobby, along with the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, the lobbying arm of 156 Jewish federations across the country. The first slap in the administration's face came on December 19th from 26 senators. They put their names on Senate Bill 1881, the quote-unquote Nuclear Weapon-Free Iran Act, which had been initiated by Cuban-born New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez and Illinois Republican Mark Kirk, two of the top recipients of pro-Israel campaign funds. Signatories included the entire Democratic Senate delegations from New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, the Senate's two leading war hawks, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, and Menendez's fellow Cubans, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, both of whom expect to be competing for the Republican nomination in 2016, and the contributions from well-heeled Israel supporters that will be needed to move their campaigns along. The legislation, not surprisingly, goes beyond current U.S. policy as well as that of its European allies that are part of the negotiations with Iran. The differences start with one, quote, "The government of Iran," it says, "must not be allowed to develop or maintain nuclear weapon capabilities," and two, "All instruments of power and influence of the United States should remain on the table to prevent the government of Iran from developing nuclear weapon capabilities," end quote. This is, of course, the Israeli government position, not Washington's or its allies, which is that simply Iran should not be allowed to build a nuclear weapon, the capability to build one being a more subjective criteria. Number three, citing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty that went into force in 1970, the bill declares that, quote, "The government of Iran does not have an absolute or inherent right to enrichment and reprocessing capabilities and technologies," end quote. The nicest thing one can say for those who initiated and those who are sponsoring this bill, that they never bothered to read the treaty, which clearly states under Article 4, quote, "Nothing in this treaty shall be interpreted as affecting the inalienable right of all the parties to the treaty to develop research, production, and use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes without discrimination and in conformity with Articles 1 and 2 of this treaty." Those articles refer to agreement by nuclear states not to assist non-nuclear states in building nuclear weapons, and by non-nuclear states, such as Iran, not to receive or solicit or attempt to build its own nuclear weapons. No proof has yet emerged, despite all the allegations, that Iran has tried to do either, while Israel, whose name is never mentioned in this discussion, and which has never signed the treaty, has done both. It received assistance from France and the U.S., and is estimated to have several hundred nuclear weapons, including some already installed in Israel's nuclear submarines. The Obama administration has conceded Iran's right to nuclear enrichment is valid. Israel and those in Congress who take orders from it and AIPAC do not. The most disturbing language in the resolution comes from its fifth resolve. Quote, "If the government of Israel is compelled to take military action in legitimate self-defense against Iran's nuclear weapon program," it states, "the United States government should stand with Israel and provide, in accordance with the law of the United States and the constitutional responsibility of Congress, to authorize the use of military force, diplomatic, military, and economic support to the government of Israel in its defense of its territory, people, and existence." In other words, these senators who have sworn an oath to defend the U.S. Constitution want to place the decision for the United States to go to war in the hands of a foreign government, in this case, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. In response, 10 Democratic Senate committee chairs wrote a letter to Majority Leader Harry Reid, urging him not to allow a vote on the bill. But they were careful not to question the patriotism of their colleagues, their willingness to let Israel push the U.S. into another war, nor the pressure applied by AIPAC on them to do so. The Iranians are cast as the deal breakers. "At this time, as negotiations are ongoing," the letter said, "we believe that new sanctions would play into the hands of those in Iran who are most eager to see negotiations fail," end quote. Among its signers were Banking Committee Chair Tim Johnson from South Dakota and California's two senators, Dianne Feinstein, Chair of the Intelligence Committee, and Barbara Boxer, Chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee. By the time the bill was published, it had added 8 additional co-sponsors, and this morning, I just learned reading the internet, the Jerusalem Post says that the number has now reached 50, which means half the Senate is siding with the Netanyahu government and AIPAC against the United States government. Where's the outrage? Writing online, political analyst Jim Loeb makes an interesting point. He says, quote, "What is remarkable about this list, however, is that very few of the 47, at the time co-sponsors, have chosen to publicize their support for the bill to their constituents through local media or other means. If this were a bill senators were excited about, they earn a lot of credit for, and not draw a lot of heat from their voters, you'd think all the co-sponsors would be proudly touting their support. Clearly, even for the Republican co-sponsors, that doesn't seem to be the case with this bill." In other words, notes Loeb, the co-sponsors appear to be targeting a very narrow constituency, AIPAC, which is now touting their names rather than their voters back home, most of whom probably have no idea what their senator's position is or what it may take. Which raises an interesting question, Loeb continues. If the folks back home knew that their senator was supporting a bill that would make another war in the Middle East more rather than less likely, would there be an outcry as there was after Obama and AIPAC asked Congress to approve military action against Syria? Well, people don't know about it, of course, because you don't hear about it on NPR, you don't hear about it on Democracy Now!, and you don't hear about it in the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal. There's a blackout on this.
That was Jeff Blankford, host of the program Takes on the World on KZYX Radio in Northern California. As I am recording this introduction on January 14, 2014, Senate Bill 1881 has reached the number of 58 co-sponsors, and supporters of S 1881 hope to add only 8 more members to reach a veto-proof majority in the U.S. Senate. You can follow this development by searching for S 1881. Add the word Iran to distinguish it from state bills with the same number. On the government website, congress.gov, you can see exactly who co-sponsored so far. And now you will hear from Professor Francis Boyer and his concern about the many flashpoints created by policies of George W. Bush and continued by Barack Obama. On January 7, 2014, Boyle had written a dark and fact-filled article. He writes that today, on the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of World War I, the serial imperial aggressions by the Republican Bush Jr. administration and then the Democratic Obama administration are now threatening to set off World War III. Boyle remembers how the Bush Jr. administration announced the establishment of the U.S. Pentagon's Africa Command, AFRICOM. That's followed by the Obama administration injecting AFRICOM into the war on Libya in violation of the U.S. Constitution. On the 100th anniversary of World War I, says Boyle, we find ourselves with the destabilized states of Libya, Iraq, Syria, and now Lebanon, along with Afghanistan, Pakistan, and a current attempt to destabilize Iran. Here's Professor Francis Boyle.
Obama was behind me at Harvard Law School, as was his wife. We had some of the same teachers, and I had hoped when he came into office that at least we would see a basic respect for the United States Constitution and principles of international law. But we have not. What we've seen is just a wholesale continuation of the Bush policies that trash international law, human rights, and the United States Constitution. In fact, Obama is even worse in the sense that he has now authorized and approved, to the extent this could be done, at least factually, the murder of United States citizens in gross violation of the Bill of Rights, and has now murdered at least 3 United States citizens that we know of. He has also, again, renewed the National Defense Authorization Act that permits the military to pick up anyone they want here in the United States for any reason they want and do whatever they want with him or her, including disappearance or transfer to another state for torture. And we know from Senator Levin's statement that, as originally drafted, this would not have applied to United States citizens. And Obama insisted that it apply to United States citizens. He also launched a completely unconstitutional war against Libya that exterminated about 50,000 Libyans and has destroyed Libya as a state. last September, he came within a hairbreadth of starting a war with Syria that would have drawn in Russia. President Putin had set a picket line of 10 Russian ships right there off the coast of Syria that could have easily degenerated into World War III. So this man is very dangerous and a serious threat to the peace of the world, and certainly a dire threat to the United States Constitution and the American people.
Well, certainly he seemed to have been bailed out of the Syrian war by the historic rejection by the British Parliament of David Cameron's call for support of the U.S. in an attack on Syria. And
well, I think we all stood up. It wasn't just the British Parliament, but I think the American people and even Congress made it quite clear we did not want what obviously would have been a catastrophic war against Syria. You'll note Obama pushed through War Powers Resolution authorization for a war against Syria through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It was extremely dangerous. It would have authorized a war also against Russia, China, and Iran, anyone basically assisting Syria or involved with Syria. And yet, over the weekend, all the support for that completely disappeared. The British were very helpful here. But, you know, it was the American people who stood up and Congress and even the Pentagon and told Obama to stand down. And, you know, by the end of that weekend, it was pretty clear he was not going to get his war powers authorization against Syria. But by comparison, he didn't even bother to get war powers authorization with respect to Libya. He just went right ahead and did it of his own accord. Clearly an unconstitutional war that is also impeachable as well. Now we have the dispute between China and Japan over the Diu Senkaku Islands, which Japan stole from China in their Imperial War of 1895. It's clear these islands are Chinese, and yet after World War II, instead of returning them to China, the United States put them under the administrative control of Japan. And now the United States, under Obama, pursuant to his policy of pivot towards Asia, is encouraging and enabling Japanese militarists, who are the direct descendants of the Japanese war criminals who gave us World War II, to dig in their heels on this matter. Both the previous Secretary of State Clinton and current Secretary of Defense Hagel have said that these little bitty rocks that Japan stole from China are subject to the applicability of the U.S. Japan self-defense treaty. And if there are hostilities between China and Japan over them, and by the way, there was just another incident yesterday, we would be obliged to come to the defense of Japan to, I guess, defend their illegal gains from 1895. So it's a very dangerous situation. Likewise, if you read the U.S.-Japan self-defense treaty, it's made very clear that only Congress can declare war against China, not the president, not the Secretary of Defense, not the Secretary of State. And yet it appears they're going to go right ahead anyway if there is a conflict here and go to war against China, which could be catastrophic. So it's a very dangerous situation now over there in the East China Sea. As you know, because you follow the Middle East, it's a dangerous situation there as well. Syria has been effectively destroyed as a state. Lebanon is being destroyed as a state. Iraq has been destroyed as a state. So it's a very unstable and dangerous situation all around and directly attributable to Obama and the people he has around him, both in the Middle East and in Asia. It's very dangerous, Jeffrey.
I wanted to actually mention that the Japanese Constitution, which was written after the war, was written to make sure that the Japan would never be a militaristic power in the region. But Yoshio Abe, the new Prime Minister of Japan, wants to change that constitution. And the United States really would like to have Japan do that as well. So Japan would become another military power.
Well, in fact, Abe is de facto changing the Showa constitution, the peace constitution. He is acting as if it is a nullity. He is currently rearming.
Yeah, you know, I want to get back actually to the Libyan situation, because what that opened up was literally a Pandora's box. Immediately we saw what happened in Mali with fighters who had left Libya, what they call jihadists, extremists, whatever, have gone into Africa, and others have gone into Syria, and the weapon stashes that were in Libya after the Gaddafi government was overthrown, they've ended up in Syria. I mean, we've seen the destabilization of the region. We look at Iraq. The United States crimes in Iraq, which were not begun by Obama but begun by Bush, we pretend that this is not our fault, that we stirred up this Shia-Sunni struggle that is stretching across the entire region. And you, as you say, you wrote early, you talked about the stretching into the Pacific and back in 100 years ago. But we have a destabilized situation which could lead to a third world war 100 years after the first one started.
That's correct. If you look across the board, indeed, I apply the analysis of my teacher, Hans Morgenthau, at the University of Chicago. He talks about unlimited imperialism, citing examples of Rome, Alexander the Great, Napoleon, and Hitler. That's exactly what the United States has set out to do after 9/11, 2001, using that as the enabler, the pretext to do so. You know, we've targeted all the oil, natural gas, and their transshipment points we can, hence the war against Libya. We've destroyed Iraq as a state deliberately. The same is being done to Syria, Lebanon. You know, the list of these things goes on. And as Morgenthau did point out, unfortunately, it does not end very well for unlimited imperialists. And my concern is that unless Obama and the government here, whoever might take Obama's place, unless we stop these people, I'm afraid somewhere they are going to set off World War III. Again, we came very close on Syria. Likewise, Bush Jr. gave the green light to Saakashvili in Georgia to attack South Ossetia, and in the process killed Russian troops that were there. And Putin did respond, whereupon they cut away Saakashvili. But that was a serious confrontation point there. Bush Jr. threatened World War III publicly against Russia over Iran after President Putin had visited there and said he didn't believe Iran had nuclear weapons. Likewise, his UN ambassador, Khalilzad, the neocon, also publicly threatened World War III. Putin has said that the deployment of U.S. ABMs in Eastern Europe and right around the borders of Russia could constitute a Cuban missile crisis in reverse, and they have now deployed Russia tactical nuclear weapons to Kaliningrad, and Obama is simply continuing to move forward with the deployment of these ABMs that are clearly part of an offensive first strike strategic nuclear weapons system to be used against both Russia and China. He is surrounding China as well with ABM systems, and he is literally rattling the tiger's cage over there. So we're going to have to get organized to try to stop this, because this is a catastrophe waiting to happen, and anything could go wrong here in their calculations about how far they could go. They came within a hairbreadth of provoking a war with North Korea over the islands there, right off their coast. The Pentagon went on a war footing. I went to bed figuring there were going to be war the next morning. China sat on North Korea saying, do not respond to their provocations. So we've had several flashpoints and war scares already. And again, reminiscent of the outbreak of World War One, and then to some extent, reminiscent of what happened in the late 1930s.
That was Francis Boyer, professor of international law at the University of Illinois. Boyle has advised many international bodies in the area of human rights, war crimes and genocide, nuclear policy, and biowarfare. Boyle served as counsel to Bosnia and Herzegovina and to the Provisional Government of the Palestinian Authority. He represented the Blackfoot Nation in Canada, the Lakota in the U.S., as well as the nation of Hawaii. Francis Boyle was interviewed by Jeff Blankfort, veteran journalist and commentator on the Middle East. Blankfort hosts Takes on the World, a program on international affairs. This program was first heard on January 8, 2014, on KZYX Radio in Mendocino County, California. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. If you have a pen handy, here's info for you to write down. On tucradio.org, you will also find the link to Senate Bill 1881 and the uscongress.gov. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for more information. A limited number of audio CDs are available online at tucradio.org or by phone at 707-463-2654. TUC Radio's secure website is tucradio.org and the email address is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.